All right. Welcome to the Look for the Learning podcast, where life is leadership and leadership is life. Today, I'm sitting here with Sardeek Love, a good friend of mine that I met on the training conference circuit. And he was one of the first people to provide me with encouragement, probably one of the people who is the reason that I'm doing this podcast today, because he asked me some thought-provoking questions that really prompt the actions that I've taken to move into the learning and development influencer space. So today I wanted to talk to him a little bit about some of his side hobbies, an interest that he has that has influenced the way that he does his work and how that work influences what he does. So I'm going to let you introduce that, Sardeek. And in the meantime, I also want you to introduce yourself a little bit. So tell everybody who you are and what you do.
Okay. Well, Artrell, it's a pleasure, obviously. So Sardeek, who is Sardeek? He's this, I like to frame myself up as the engagement expert. That's what I'm known professionally in terms of on the leadership side of things, as well as on the training side, creating massive participant engagement. But at heart, I'm just a kid that grew up in Mount Vernon, New York, who's fulfilling and living his dream. And as we go through this, I'm sure we'll kind of tap back into a lot of the things that I've done that are literally things I dreamed of as a kid and have just fulfilled those throughout my life. I'm one of those dream catchers that creates dreams that come true. So, and outside of that, one of the things that got me started and what we'll probably talk about here is martial arts. I was always a fan of Bruce Lee. I have five older brothers. I'm the last of seven, and I have five older brothers, two of which were martial artists. And so you can imagine what happened to me being the youngest. You know, sometimes I would get jacked, right? So some of this, and then growing up in Mount Vernon, New York, you know, fighting back then in my day and age was commonplace with kids in the neighborhood. So the Karate Kid was not far too far from from my childhood, although it wasn't serious like in the movies, but we would scrap a little bit here and there.
Okay, so you had lots of competition in the house. What order are you in that lineup there?
In terms of belt rank or in terms of or what other?
The ones that used to kick you in the face back in the day.
They were all older, so I was number seven out of all of them. But in terms of belt rank, I ended up getting the highest ranked belt, so nobody messes with me now.
You got good sense, apparently.
Yeah, I have one run in with one older brother, which I'm sure we'll come back to at some point, and I'll just leave a little teaser. It didn't go so well for him.
And are you still active in martial arts, or is this just something that you did as you were developing into who you are today?
Yeah, no, I'm not as active because I'm going to be tomorrow is my 57th birthday. So at this point in my life, if I tried to do some of the things I did 20, 30 years ago, I would probably tear something. I'd probably need lots of, you know, Advil and things like that. But, you know, I got to red belt in Taekwondo, which the next belt for me was black belt. So I was pretty senior level active back in college. That's where I officially learned it at Virginia Tech. And so, I mean, once you learn those things, it's a lifelong thing, especially at that level, you don't forget them. But I wouldn't try to kick somebody in the face now. It'd be a well-placed kick to the knee.
Well, I think I saw a picture of you. I don't know if you sent it to me individually or if it was a post that you had put on LinkedIn, but I do recall seeing you still having some kind of moves left in you. You might not be able to do them as often or as many times as you used to, but I think you still got something in the tank.
There's a little bit in there. So you're referring to a jump side kick. So what most people will remember from a Bruce Lee kick, where he would jump on and throw his kicks out. That's a staple in Taekwondo and many other styles. And so I have photos of me doing it back in, 25 years ago. And then I decided I was on a beach in Costa Rica, saw the sunset, and I had this Karate Kid moment. I was like, I think I can do that kick and get the sunset behind me. And, granted, it looks great when you look at that photo. But I'm literally like a foot off the ground. Whereas before I had a 36 inch vertical leap, so I could literally jump up and kick people pretty close to their, you know, chest and depending upon the height. But on sand, I was basically a foot off the ground, but I could still do that kick.
Well, perspective is anything, right? You use the right camera, know the difference. So tell me a little bit about what you do professionally.
It's evolved over the years, Artrell, and what I landed on many years ago, because I kept oscillating in and out of what do I want to be a training professional or do I want to be focused on leadership? Because I've been engaged and inspired and intrigued by both disciplines, if you will. And then more recently, and I say basically over the last 10 years, I started to figure out that this bifurcation of interests, leadership, and trying to understand why leaders do what they do, and then trainers and training people and developing people, they actually have the same principles at their basis and foundation. And that led me to, instead of trying to figure out either or, it became an and. And that common denominator is engagement. So, you know, the Gallup organization is known, and I started studying engagement, employee engagement, right back when Marcus Buckingham, who made it famous from the Gallup organization back in, what was that, 19, I think it was 99, he released somewhere in there, First Break All the Rules, What Great Managers Do Differently. And I'm a voracious reader. So I read that, and I started following him obsessively in the Gallup organization. And at that point, I was in management. So I wanted to understand how to be better and things like that. And then I came back into the training function and loved that piece too. And so over the years, I've just kind of figured out that those two, engagement, whether it's participant engagement in a classroom or employee engagement, the foundational principles based on neuroscience are all the same. And so I've built my career now with a heavy focus over the last 5 years, moving into the neuroscience and psychology of engagement. Marcus and the Gallup organization, they kind of set the foundation. What I figured out is there are other things that neuroscience, which we've learned over the last 10 years about the brain, have supported a lot of what he did and what they found, but then it's opening up a whole new space. So I'm in that space. That's where I'm claiming it.
So you're not just studying what he did, but you're also continuing upon the learnings and building your own foundation there too.
Yeah, because at the core of what I do is habit formation, right? And that's really what I am. I look at performance consulting and how people perform, and all those performance results are just habits, the results of habits. So everything we do is a routine. We're wired to be, as humans, we're wired to be very routine, and we don't pay attention to things that are routine. Once we get a habit built, we just go. And so our habits either make us or break us. And so the matter of trying to figure out what habits lead to the outcomes you want, that's where I focus. And so the same thing with habits of thinking and doing, that's the engagement piece. I figured out how to go into this direction with it and build off of the foundation of what they did. But now it's creating and opening up a whole new set of opportunities and exploration and just isolating certain habits that if you get these right, you know, you can kick off some pretty amazing results over time.
And you know, I follow you on the various methods of social media and through which you post, particularly on LinkedIn. And for those that will follow Sardiq as well, we'll talk about that a little bit later, but I know we'll get to see a lot more about this topic. And I look forward to the way that you present this. We've got the martial arts guy who got kicked in the face back in the day, who's turned into an engagement expert facilitating. You didn't mention international keynote speaker, but I'll put it out there. I've seen you on the big stages across the world. So you've taken principles that you've learned through martial arts, and now you start to apply them in your professional journey. And that's probably not just in what you do today, but as you've developed into this professional that you are, you've taken some principles from martial arts, which is what Look for the Learning is all about, in finding those ways in which we apply our other hobbies and interests to our leadership and how our leadership may even influence the way that we approach those hobbies and interests. So let's talk a little bit about how your martial arts background has guided you where you are and may still guide you in doing what you do.
You know, it's really interesting. When I think about this, I think about my practice of martial arts. Back in those days, it was all in college, is all about, you know, the bravado of the ego of the guy. And, you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme and Steven Seagal and all those guys were running around kicking people in the face. And so I was all into that, although I was doing it from a competitive perspective. So, but one of the things that the Jun Ri Taekwondo Club at Virginia Tech and Charlie Lee, who was the instructor or the sensei, one thing he was really focused on was not just the physical aspects, which most of us are drawn to, but the mental aspects. And what I find now as over the years, that is what has played much more of a role in my adult life as opposed to the physical stuff. And so one of the instructors from the competing club at Virginia Tech was the Virginia Tech Taekwondo Club. So yeah, Jun Ri, which was where I was, and then the Virginia Tech Taekwondo Club. And we would have competitions amongst each other. And they were fun. There was never any animosity like in a Karate Kid situation. But one of the instructors over there became very good friends, Sung Bae Lee. And Sung actually lives here in Manassas, where I live. And so what we have done, we reconnected once I came to Northern Virginia, and we just get together on a regular basis. He's one of my closest, he is my closest friend, dearest confidant. And we just get together, man, and sometimes the conversations that we have are deep. And I'm sure people looking at us, and if they hear our conversations, they're like, what are they talking about? But it's all rooted in from our background in martial arts, and we go over that. So I'll just kind of simply say it this way, and then we can keep going any direction you want. But the mental aspects of martial arts have been hugely influential. And so when I think about from the neuroscience perspective these days of attachment theory, and if people don't know what these are, you can Google this stuff. But we all have different types of attachment. So there's attachment theory, whether you look at DISC or Myers-Briggs or all these different types of assessments. Martial arts actually teaches all of those things. So mindset, mind shift, Carol Dweck's, you know, mindset stuff. All that is a lot of it is rooted in the philosophies of martial arts that are taught for the mental side of it. So I've always been pretty calm, man. And that's, you know, as a person. And so when all heck is breaking loose around me, I'm usually pretty self-disciplined to kind of look at the situation. And that comes directly from the martial arts. Because, yeah, as a young kid, I was actually pretty high strung and pretty competitive. And I would, you know, go at it. Not anymore.
Can you think of a time where you might have recently needed to apply those skills, or not even consciously, but maybe you had to look back afterwards and say, whoa, if it weren't for my experience in Taekwondo, I probably wouldn't have handled that situation as well as I did. Or if I had applied what I learned in Taekwondo, I would have done something a little differently than the way that I responded in the moment. So are there any specific situations that you can think of in your adult life after this has been kind of locked in? Now you know it and it's ingrained, but you still habitually reverted to those behaviors and understood how it would benefit you in certain situations or in that specific situation.
Well, I can give you one that stands out in my mind. It's not quite so recent. It's several years ago, but there was a time, you know, where I was with now my ex-wife, and we had gone to dinner, and we were in a parking lot, and I pulled out, and I was driving to get out of the parking lot. There were really only two ways out of this shopping area in the parking lot that we were in. And there was a guy sitting in an SUV, and I have an SUV, and he was sitting. And as we came to the, and I'll do it this way so you can see, as we came up, he was blocking that one exit out, and he was on his phone, and he was kind of like in a T-section blocking us, and there was no way to get around him. So I waited, you know, thinking he would look up, and he didn't look up. So I softly honked my horn, and he looked up, and then I could see him mouthing something. I couldn't tell if he was talking to somebody on the phone or whatever. And he starts pulling, you know, up to us. And as he got a little closer, because he was a bit far off from us, as he got closer, I could see the emotions on his face. And I was like, okay, that's probably not good. And he's coming, and he starts to roll his window down. So now I'm thinking, okay. So as he comes up to me, I can hear him sort of, and I roll my window down. And he's very angry at me. He's like, hey, why you honk your horn at me? And he just goes on and on. He's unhinged at this point. He's like, why you honk your horn at me? Blah, 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 cursing and all that. And I just looked at him. Now, you know, back in the day, this might have gone very differently. But I'm sitting there thinking, I was like, I'm not trying to go to jail. I'm not trying to get killed. I'm not trying to kill him, get anybody hurt over something as simple as I'm just trying to go home. So from the martial arts background, I stayed completely calm. And I just said to him in a very calm voice, I said, hey, man, I'm just trying to go home, trying to take the wife home. That's all. I said it just like that. And he still's going and going. I said, hey, I'm sorry. I just wanted to let you know I was there. I'm just trying to go home. I'm sure you want to go home too. And he's like, yeah, well, next time don't be honking at me, son. And I was like, no problem. And, you know, he went on about his business and I went on about my business. 25 years ago, we might have been outside the cars, but I don't have, you know, the martial arts has taught me to be very calm about situations when people are unhinged, usually just do a pattern disruption or something like that. And that's also from a professional perspective, pattern disruptions, calm people down once the amygdala is tripped. So that's one of my more frightening but real scenarios of me applying what I learned from the mental side of martial arts.
Well, you just mentioned a term that I've heard before but don't have a lot of familiarity with, and that might be the case with others listening, pattern disruption. What was it about that situation that allowed you to be able to apply a pattern disruption technique to diffuse the situation, or at least to not escalate it any further?
Yeah. So typically we're all wired to be a pattern, you know, creatures of habit. And so we get in our natural patterns. And when people are, especially in conflict situations, people are, they've tripped over and they become, go from rational to irrational. And that's why when people are upset, they can say things and they can do things that make completely no sense whatsoever. They're just complete. And this is where you see mob theory. So you can take a very solid, law-abiding citizen, put them into a mob situation, and just because of the nature of all the things going on around them, they will could get triggered and start doing things with the mob, where otherwise they would know not to do that or wouldn't be their norm. So when the amygdala gets tripped and we go into irrational thinking, the only way to get them out of that is to do a disruption to that. And usually it takes staying calm as opposed to reacting, because we're emotional, contagious people. Whatever we see in others affects us and affects our mood. Now, a lot of this I didn't know until I started studying neuroscience and psychology. And that's why when you think about it, and here's some just a quick stat on this, people around you infect your mood within 5 seconds. So whether they're happy or not, that's why if you're around somebody that's upset, you start to feel it fairly quickly just by, and we can't control that. That's a human neuron thing. So when people are tripped over like that and they become irrational, the best thing to do is to disrupt their pattern. And then if you just think about pattern disruptions in general, if you want to intrigue, engage, or connect with somebody on a very deep level, do things that they don't expect. The brain looks for predictable things. When you do things that are not anticipated or not predictable, that's when you actually can engage on a deeper level.
Now, because of my experience with the classroom facilitation and the type of speaking that you do, I know that you've had to apply that in those settings too. I think you even told me about a situation recently where you had people kind of act out in class. And because you are an independent consultant, because you want to make sure that you remain professional in those situations, and not necessarily impact your client relationship due to the responses of someone who may be in one of your groups, you have to apply that same type of pattern disruption technique. Can you think about a situation, or do you want to share one of those situations that you've shared with me before about people who've done things in class that you also had to refer to the same experience?
Yeah. And, you know, by the way, I'll mention this too, Artrell, with your background in comedy, this is all the stuff that y'all doing as a comic is those pattern disruptions and take people in one way and do it the other way. So studying all this helps me understand selling, helps me understand comedy. And I love watching comedians like you just do your craft. So, but yeah, in the classroom space, and this is something that has been happening a lot more since the pandemic. You know, the pandemic changed a lot about human behavior and how we interact. And in some cases, the boldness that people are willing to demonstrate and unleash, whereas before it was a little bit more muted. Now it's not so much, and people are much more willing to show undesirable and sometimes very disruptive behaviors. And one in particular that happened last year was in Dallas. And I had a class where I was teaching facilitation to, and this was a full group of like 25 people. And it was a 3-day class, and everyone knew coming into this course that on the third day, they would be delivering in small groups in their table groups, a teach back, a practice teach back. So they're going to build their presentation, applying what they've learned in that class on the third day. And so on day two, as I was just kind of talking through some of the planning for their preparation for the presentation on the next day, one of the things that I use a lot of is one-liners, quick one-liners and catchy phrases. And that's in my second book, How to Do That. And so a young lady in the kind of back of the room, she said, she raised her hand. She said, I have a question. And I said, yes. And she said, I don't need any more of your one-liners, because all you've done is sat here and give us all these one-line phrases that are catchy. I need to know, what am I expected to do tomorrow with my presentation? I need a script. And she was very agitated. I hadn't noticed this about her. So I stopped the class and I literally walked to her, and there was an empty seat at the table right across from her. And in front of everybody, I sat down in front of her and I said, so what can I and or us do to help you feel more comfortable and more prepared? So I didn't take the bait of her against me and what she was saying. I'm trying to address her needs. And she went off and she just started saying, well, I don't have this and I don't have that. So I asked her a question. I said, how long have you been in training? And she said, this is my third week. Now, that's when the crowd, I knew exactly what was going to happen. And see, I knew this about her. So that's when the crowd, and we had some very experienced people and some inexperienced, but one of the experienced ladies said, you've been in training for 3 weeks and you're telling one of the most experienced people I've ever met that he's not giving you what you need. Honey, where have you been? Now, I knew that was going to happen. So I had to pull them off of her. And I said, no, hold on. I said, let's look at it from her perspective, because we all have been there trying to learn how to ride a bike. And remember, we ran into that post, you know, that wall or that mailbox. She's learned how to ride. And so I turned it back to her and I said, so what is it that you need? What do you feel most comfortable with? And that's when she came out and said in front of everybody, she said, I don't know. I have panic attacks. And that's when I realized, I was like, okay, now I need to take this offline, because she's in a panic mode. And so I said, okay, let's take a break, everybody. And we took a break. I took her off and calmed her down. She was fine. Now, an inexperienced facilitator or somebody who's not used to knowing how to diffuse situations, they would have been completely freaked out. And don't get me wrong, man, I was a little bit freaked out when she said panic attack. But I knew at that point that was a trigger for me to say, okay, this group thing isn't the way to finish this up. So bringing in the group and helping them support her. And what I noticed after that, and I'll kind of stop talking here, is when we came back together, her table group really kind of leaned in on her and supported her and helped her get through that rest of that class so that she was done. And so that's the kind of stuff when you can remain calm despite things that might be going on, somebody's doing something disruptive, just calmness and questions are a phenomenal thing.
And I heard quite a few things in what you said there that got me thinking about my son's experience in Taekwondo. And he's at the point now where they get to spar a little bit. I don't know if I would be good at sparring, because I feel like if somebody hit me the wrong way or hard enough, that I'm going to get angry and not remain calm, like you just mentioned. So I know that there's some elements in Taekwondo that teach you that have to still be able to maintain your composure. Because what I also know about being in a fight in general, just because I've seen it on TV, that when you're in that aggressive situation, you may lose control and not do it as well as you normally would. So it's not just about maintaining your composure because you don't want to have the conflict, but if you allow your emotions to get too involved, you may not be able to perform the way that you need to. So I hear some of that in what you just mentioned, and I want to give you the opportunity to speak a little bit about how you get to apply, how those leadership principles are applied in Taekwondo, just as you mentioned. Your Taekwondo principles are applied in leadership.
Yeah, and that's a great insight, especially given the fact that your son is involved, because all of us in the martial arts arena, when you spar, you're going to get that person at some point that is overzealous. And even though they'll say no contact or minimal contact, they're going full contact, you know, and they'll hit you and tick you off, right? And that's the key. That's when that mental aspect of it kicks in, where the person, and I never forgot Charlie Lee. I can't get it exactly the way he said it, but the message was, the person who remains in control controls the outcome. And he didn't say it quite that way, but that's the way I envisioned it as I think about it now. The person that remains in control controls the outcome. So because the person who loses control, the outcome is undetectable, it's unpredictable. It could go a variety of different ways. And so that's definitely something that strong leaders and, again, facilitators, and I have a quote that I use around this that kind of comes right out of that discipline from martial arts. Great facilitators, great leaders, great martial artists trade control for contribution. So I'm not trying to control you. I'm trying to control your contribution to adding value. So definitely staying in control of things of yourself, because that's the only thing you can control, helps you navigate and predict. One other thing from a martial arts perspective around this is, in most martial arts disciplines, you're taught to not look at necessarily the eyes of what a person is doing, but look at the torso, because that is going to be the predictor of what they're going to do next. Because they can look away from you and do a spinning kick. But if you watch the body, and then you can start to anticipate the direction of what they're going to do. Boxers are also somewhat taught this. And that's what great leaders do. They should anticipate what their employees need, anticipate what direction they're going to go, and give them that direction. And that's the guidance that leaders do. And again, so that's a principle right out of any martial arts discipline.
I love the insight that you just gave there in that quote, trading control for contribution. I see it all over what I've done. I just never really had that framework to place it in that context the way that you just did. I also think about how you talked about the motions of the body. And when we play basketball, I heard as we started to advance through those levels, and it was more than just doing the backyard stuff, but as some of the guys really started to get good and I didn't, but somebody told me to watch their feet. They said, don't even worry about what their hands or their eyes are doing. Watch the individual's feet. And I know there's a lot more to it than that, but as you spoke about watching the body, mm-hmm. and then you talked about how leaders need to watch their organizations and watch the individuals. And so if you use that metaphor of the organization being a body or having a body, then mm-hmm. I can also see you applying some of these leadership concepts there. So just wanted to prompt a little thought and see what your thoughts may be around leadership perceptions like that, being able to watch a certain part of your organization to understand where that organization may be going and what you may need to do to either prevent or respond.
You know, I credit that. And again, great insights on your part here. I credit my ability to do that back to one of my mentors, and he was my boss at the same time, Milton Taylor at what was Blue Cross Blue Shield of Virginia, but then eventually I was bought by Anthem. And Milton was the head of the risk management department. So in an insurance company, you have the sales organization, the operations organization, and the risk mitigation department that looks at how they're selling insurance and in making sure that they make a profit. So that risk management part of it makes and ensures the policies are set so that there's a margin or a profit there. So I worked for him, and that was a lot of projection and anticipating whatever the CEO and the senior leaders would say. We need to have these margins. We always had to anticipate based on what the company set, where we would place the risk factors. So if you think of it as almost like a stock market anticipation type of thing. And so we were taught under his leadership how to look at where the company was positioning itself, and then what was operations tactically doing on a daily, weekly, monthly basis? What were their operational processes that was enabling or disabling the execution of our risk strategy combined with sales? So when you put all that stuff together, we were forecasters. And so that fit right into my martial arts background. That fit right into what I've become now as a performance consultant and engagement. It's just looking at the patterns of decisions that are being made and what are the likely outcomes? Because there's always three outcomes and only three outcomes in anything we do. You get better, you get worse, or you stay the same. And as Milton would say, no one pays for two of those, right? No one's going to pay to stay the same. No one's going to pay to get worse. We're all in the game of getting better. So everything we do has to be in that direction. And so I flip that over into value as a leader. You know, there are three outcomes: stay the same, get worse, or get better. Everything you as a leader should do should be helping you and your team add value so that things get better. Because if not, you have to question what you're doing.
Wow. Now, you mentioned forecasting, and I never never thought about forecasting being a part of martial arts. I also really think about it more from a financial perspective, from a business perspective, operations perspective, when we want to forecast production outputs and things like that. But you just put it into a context that helped me to understand that forecasting takes place in a lot of other ways, too. And if you don't mind even elaborating a little bit on how that forecasting mindset that you just described is applied in Taekwondo and in your leadership.
Yeah. So from a Taekwondo perspective, again, it comes back to looking at that torso and seeing where, you know, anticipating where they're going to go, what their likely next move is. And that's where for boxers, they learn to punch counterpunch methodologies and tactics. So, you know, Taekwondo teaches you that. And then also watching the level of aggression, you know, that the person's coming to you with is going to give you some indication as to how much power is going to be behind their techniques or how much emphasis they're going to put on certain things. And that allows you to, and this is, although I've never studied this discipline, this is one I've always wanted to study, is Aikido, is redirecting people's energy against them and using it against them. So the Navy SEALs, I recently read a book by Rich DeVinny, and the book is titled, if I get it correct, Masters of Uncertainty, I think is what it's called. And Rich DeVinny, if I'm not mistaken, I think he was, or if he wasn't the top leader of the SEAL 16 that did the raid on Osama bin Laden, he was one of the leaders. And it's a very short book. And what he talks about in there when it comes back to, you know, principles. So you imagine the SEALs, they learn hand-to-hand combat, weapons mastery, and all that. And what they're all about doing in this book, and he talks about, he says, the masters of uncertainty, we plan, we anticipate, we practice and practice and practice until we can't practice anymore about the theater of which we're going to go into. But then once we're in the theater, which is the place of combat, things go wrong. And so, but we've practiced and anticipated so many different potential outcomes, we can go on and still complete the mission. And so in that book, he actually talks at the very beginning of the book, he explains how they had built that compound, an exact mock replica of Osama bin Laden's compound. And so they knew every nook and cranny as best they could. But when they were landing with the two helicopters, one of the helicopters, people know now, famously crashed. And so now they still had to execute their mission and get out with one less helicopter and get everybody out of there safely. He said, and the reason we're able to do that is because we were masters of uncertainty. We anticipated everything that we can think of, including a loss of transport. I was like, yo, that is some deep stuff. So that's what we're talking about, is really thinking through it. And you can only plan but so much, but you got to leave some room for the unanticipated and the unpredictable, and then have a plan for dealing with it.
It makes me think about never underestimating the power of practice and the power of experience. A lot of times we go into situations, and I know people say all the time, I'll just watch a YouTube video, and they think that they're a subject matter expert because they've done it one time with the guidance of this YouTuber. But there are situations that arise, and yes, the ideal scenarios might allow us to follow the rules step by step. But when we don't understand the fundamentals, especially, then you'll run into situations that aren't in the manual and you don't necessarily know how to respond to it. All of the leadership influences that we listen to talk about having the end in mind, starting with the end in mind. That's Covey, right? And I'm pretty sure that with the SEALs, they all knew the outcome that they wanted. But then you just kind of have to fill in the middle. You prepare for different things to happen there. But then everybody has to stay focused on what the outcome is supposed to be. And as long as they're still on the same page with that, then you should get to the finish line. And there's so many different examples that we could probably go through where we talk about just starting with the end in mind and knowing, as long as you know where you want to go, the way that you get there may not be as important. Or when you have disruptions in between, as long as you know where you need to end up, you can still get there. So I love the way that you frame that there. And I'm going to have to check out the book too, Masters of Uncertainty, in which you also referred to it as the theater, which is another episode. But it's one of those spaces in which, yes, we are performing as speakers, as a facilitator, there's a performance that had to have been practiced over and over again, the comedy, the taekwondo, because you'll run into situations that you have to respond. And if it's not in the manual, you can't fall apart. I've done it.
You know, man, I'll tell you this too. One of the most famous stories that is an example of what we're talking about is the whole power of practice and everything is, and as soon as I say it, everybody who's watching this will understand it, at least from the American perspective. And that is the Miracle on the Hudson, you know, and the Captain Sullenberger. And what most people, if you don't know the story, and I'm not going to go into it all, but just how was he able to land an Airbus A320 with 100, whatever it was, 78 or 200 passengers in the Hudson? Because very few times has a plane landed in water where it didn't have complete catastrophe and break apart. How was he able to do that? The one thing, the one habit, the one skill that he had that went underrepresented and undercelebrated was he was a glider pilot. So all he did was, and he explains it, that he did glider pilot things with an Airbus A320, you know, and brought that thing in. He understood pitches. And if you go watch Google the interview that he did with Katie Couric, that specific interview in particular is where he talks about, she asks him, you know, because of the aerodynamics and planes typically breaking apart and killing everybody, how did he manage to pull that off? And he explains how from his glider pilot experience, he knew aerodynamically exactly how to hit the water. That's what practice does. They practice for when engines go out, but no one practices for landing in the water. That dude practiced. So there's a good example of that one.
And that's looking for the learning too, right? That's applying something, concepts that you've learned from something else to that current situation.
Exactly.
And that's what makes us unique, right? Mm-hmm. It's that thing that it took me a long time to be able to communicate in job interviews, because when they would say, do you have experience doing a thing, on the surface, we may not have had that job that they're asking us about, or we may not have completed that task that they're referencing at the time. But when you dig deep enough, and that's really what the premise of the podcast is supposed to help us be able to do, is to dig a little bit deeper and say, I can apply the skills of this area of expertise that I have to this other thing. And that's mm-hmm. what helps unique. And I know that Taekwondo experience is one of the reasons why Sardiq Love is the well-known, renowned, acclaimed author, speaker, facilitator that you are, because of that unique training that you've received and the way that you've applied that to this professional lens. So I'm glad that you're here, and I really appreciate you being able to tie some of your Taekwondo philosophies to our field, because I'll pay more attention when my son is in class, for sure. If nothing else, right? Now,
one thing that Taekwondo teaches you is failure is not getting kicked in the face. It's not getting kicked in the face multiple times. Mm-hmm. You know, and when you are punched in the face, when you learn that, just like a baseball player, you know, their batting average, if you hit over 25%, that's considered probably darn near world, you know, renowned kind of stuff. That means 75% of the time you're not hitting the ball. And the same thing with Taekwondo, failure is just nothing more than feedback. And the goal is to increase your odds. And to your point, you know, I'm a kid that grew up with a single parent at the time, last of seven kids in Mount Vernon, New York. My mom worked in a dry cleaners. She did not finish high school. But the one thing that she instilled in me was keep going, be the best that you can be. And she made some decisions in her life to help position me for my life. So I appreciate all the things that she did. But the one thing that she always put into me, she was like, no matter what, keep going. And I've never forgotten that. So I just learned to adapt and pivot and adapt, because that's what mom told me I needed to do. And apparently she's been right.
Now, Taekwondo, you said that there's a quote that you've taken from Taekwondo. When have you had to apply that, or how did that help you grow to get to the, did you say it was the red belt that you had achieved?
Yeah. So, in just different styles of Taekwondo or even martial arts in general, belts can mean different things, but for your audience, in my style, in particular discipline, it would go red and then to black. Some would have red, then brown to black. But basically, once you get the red belt, you're a senior belt. You're considered pretty close to black belt. And and quite frankly, I stopped and didn't pursue the black belt for two reasons. One, I could have gotten it before I graduated. But at the time, once you became a black belt, if you ever used it in real situation, you would have to tell somebody by law that you're a black belt because it's considered a deadly weapon. And I didn't want to have that burden. Not that I anticipated I would ever get into a fight because I'm non-combative like that. But I didn't want to announce to anybody that, hey, I've got a black belt. And then they go, okay, well, let's explain how I got a kabang. So, you know, I'm not going to do that. So the black belt is just, for me now, it's a self-actualization thing to get it at some point. But coming back to your point, Archel, the thing of it is the person who controls, remains in control, controls the outcome. That has always been an underpinning of who I am and kind of actually helped me figure out what I am in life. And so when I look at being the engagement expert in almost everything that I do, it's my first thinking is, okay, what can I control? Because most of what we experience in life, we have no direct control over. So control the controllables and you can affect the outcome. Even when things go wrong, like none of us could have predicted or controlled the outcome of or the issue with the pandemic. But when that hit and I, you know, at that time I had 95% of my business was in person. So overnight, like many people, my business was gone for all intents and purposes. And I took the next, so that was March, April, May, June, July. I took the next 3 months to say, I said, what can I control? And the one thing I recognized very quickly was one thing I had that most training professionals didn't have was I had a lot of experience delivering training in an engaging way virtually. 90%+ of training professionals did not have that experience. So I pivoted very quickly. I watched for 3 months what I could control, watched for 3 months, did research, did webinars to gather data, and figured out that I could teach people virtually how to train virtually. And that's what got me through the pandemic. And I literally was 2 weeks away from being going into deep bankruptcy and not being able to pay bills or anything. And Procter & Gamble came along and said, a senior leader said, I want you to train my entire team in this Master Virtual Presenter program. And that pulled me out of the doldrums of going into bankruptcy and financial ruin. And to this day, I love Procter & Gamble for that. That one decision that she made gave me enough revenue to then build off of that from there. So what could I control? Where were the needs that others had? I couldn't control what was happening, but I could control what I could add value to. When you do that kind of stuff and you understand this mindset, really, it's a persevering thing. It allows you to adapt and pivot where most people panic and procrastinate.
I like it. Let's talk about failure. I know everything hasn't always gone right. Got to the point where you just mentioned that there was almost the financial, it may have been a failure. You got close, but you were able to avoid that at the time. But I know everything always gone right for Sardiq. Let's talk about a situation that you might have had to reassess the way that you were doing things because it didn't go the way that you wanted to. And you applied some of those same principles that you've discussed from Taekwondo to move forward. You know, I don't know if that ultimately turned into a success or if it's just one of those things that you've had to chalk up and say, I wish I had the opportunity to do it differently, but I at least learned from it.
So failure, we all experience that. And I'm not just like everybody else. I'm not immune to it. And I actually had to end up from the pandemic for a different reason. I had to end up filing for my ex-wife and I, we ended up filing for bankruptcy. Because at that time, the pandemic, I saw no way out. And not to divulge too much about my prior wife and everything, but we had a financial situation that due to health reasons, we were accumulating debt that I couldn't, no matter how much my income is unrestricted in terms of based on my capability of selling, there was no way I could just get out of that. So ultimately, and begrudgingly, I made the decision, we made the decision to go ahead and declare for bankruptcy. Now, what that did was gave me a clean slate to take that stress off of me and her. Because it was just, I mean, it was debilitating. I rarely ever like stress out to the point where I'm in tears. And for many times, I think back to 2020. So from that period, I made that decision, but I was in tears. And I was like, you know what? My ego was hurt and all that. But then I did research on all this. And I don't mind sharing this. And because some people out there might have this situation where they need to to have this comfort. When I did the research about bankruptcy and trying to understand what impact it would have, I realized very quickly, I was like, this is why people do it. That's what it's there for, is to get you out of a debilitating, stressful situation so you get a clean slate. Now, you got to pay the price for several years. But the advantage that I had was, is because I'm independent, things like that, I could recoup some of things because I'm not tied to a day-to-day job where I have a specific salary. So because of my ability to sell, I was able to recoup credit and get credit fairly quickly. Organizations see somebody like me and they're like, oh yeah, this guy, business owner, he's going to make that money. So we can trust him with some. And so I rebuilt fairly quickly. But that was an ego trip that was mad crazy. And it was painful. Now I'm like, I'm glad I did it. Cause I was like, I should have done it sooner than I thought. I sat there for quite a while dealing with the bills on the health side of things that just growing. And there was nothing that I could do to outstrip that. Now, having said that, you know, so I built all around that and I took lessons from that and said, okay, what would I need to do differently? And you actually met somebody that I started dating after my, you know, wife and I had broken up, and that went great for a little bit. And then it just went pow and went away. I mean, I was like, what the hell just happened? And you and I have talked about that a little bit. And so when I look back, there were signs that I could see in certain behaviors that I didn't pay attention to, what they call in relationships, red flags. So despite my ability in a professional world to be fairly sustainable and persevering, and, you know, and I was married for 10 years, we were together 14. So it was a great time for the most part. We just grew apart and there were other things that contributed to that. But on a personal level, so the relationship coming out of that and then having a relationship that looked good, and then I didn't see red flags in that person from an emotional perspective that should have told me, pause, I didn't see that. That was another failure. So that's what led me into a little bit more around research, around neuroscience and attachment theories. And because I'm just that type of person, when I have a failure, I do a deep dive to try to figure out what to not to do in the future. So I share that on a personal level just to say that when it happens, and it will happen, the key is to not let it happen again and repeat it. So lessons learned. Failure is nothing but lessons learned. Now, if you get a person who continues to repeat those lessons, that's a sign that maybe they're not the right fit.
Yeah, but you referenced a recency bias that we all often fall into. There was something that stood out to you in the last relationship, so you had this heightened awareness. It's probably also RAS, right? The reticular activating system.
Exactly.
That so much for this thing that you miss some of the other things.
Exactly.
Now, I do know enough about martial arts to know that ego is something that they try to, you know, you suppress it. You don't want to allow to get too involved. And as we start to wrap up this conversation where you talked about failure, you mentioned that the ego trip was part of the failure. The ego was what had to recognize and be aware of in order to help move you in the direction that you needed to go. What other concepts around ego help you to be able to avoid those failures? And maybe even that you recognized in a situation like you just described, where it was the ego that kind of put you in the place where you were.
So it's a natural thing for all of us. We have ego and self-worth and all that. One of the things that when you get enough failure, and this is usually how it happens, you have to have enough pain before you'll change, right? So I had enough pain in my personal life. I'm like, all right, what the heck? The common denominator here is me, whether I want to admit it or not. There's certain things that I'm not looking at, I'm not seeing, and I was avoiding because I didn't want to admit that I was not making the right decisions, things like that. So I reverted back to part of my research was a book that I read years ago. By John Maxwell. It's one of my all-time favorites, called Failing Forward. And as much as I read that book years ago and practiced a lot of that, when the stuff hits the fan and you're in the middle of all that chaos and your ego is right there shining bright saying, look at me, look at me, don't admit anything. I have forgotten those principles. But one book that has come onto the market now, again, this is based on neuroscience, and I'll give your audience this one, Mel Robbins' recent book called Let Them Theory. Read it. because that is a lot. And this, she's looked at some things around stoicism, and what the way that martial arts teaches you is a stoic way of suppressing your ego. And that is to accept failure as a lesson of learning, to not repeat it, and then to not attach the outcome of failure or success to your identity. Now, this is particularly difficult to do because we're wired to attach our identity to our ego and vice versa. But when you can learn to detach from the outcome of any situation, it allows you to suppress the ego. So what I learned back in martial arts is coming full circle, you know, with the neuroscience and looking at let them theory. So if someone doesn't like you, let them. If someone has a problem with you, let them. People don't have, they don't agree with my philosophies and my principles. Okay. I'm good with that. And so another way I like to say it is, I don't care. I care to a point, but if you give me feedback that adds no value where I can't figure out what to change, if it's just your opinion, opinions are like rear ends. Everybody's got one. And I have the right to use or not use your opinion. So now that I've reached that level of detachment, I'm not tied to an outcome. I'm tied to the journey. And that allows you to suppress your ego to a certain degree.
And I love the fact that you did pull it full circle, because those are some of the things that you were taught in a completely different part of your life that until now, because we've got a book and I've been seeing this book show up everywhere. There are people posting about it, and it's actually been recommended to me a couple times on my Audible. Mm-hmm. So your recommendation, I should go ahead, and if I don't get the physical book, at least throw it in my earbuds while I'm driving or something, because I've got a flight that I'm going to be taking in the next day or so. And that'll probably be great material for me to consume during that too. So there's been so much that you've given me, and I know that everybody who listens is going to take their own pieces away from it. But just to recap, you started out the conversation talking about the pattern disruptions, and that really stood out to me, how the amygdala can sometimes hijack us and cause us to respond in certain ways. But through Taekwondo, you realized, awareness that this happens, which then allows you to control the response that you have to any given situation, whether it be someone trying to physically do something to you, as we said, kick you in the face, or someone disrupts what's going on when you are speaking to people, whether it be in the classroom or one of those large group settings that you speak in. You mentioned the person who remains in control controls the outcome. And that one really stood out to me. And you had us look at the torso of our organization. And when we understand how the body moves, how the organization moves, that helps us remain in a certain level of control. When you understand what someone else is about to do, you can either keep them from doing it, or you can influence them to do something different, or use that motion, because I've seen in martial arts particularly that sometimes one's own motion can be used against them. I know you've done that before. The projection and anticipation, we need to be doing that. I've been forecasting. I've been sitting in the front of rooms forecasting what may happen next, how I may need to do something differently to control that situation. But now I'm a lot more aware based on what you said too. And then when we apply that ego trip theory that you talked about there, in ensuring that our ego doesn't get in the way, because that is often the reason that we fail. Our ego, not only does it cause us to fail, but it defines what the failure is, because without the ego, we wouldn't even care, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. If I get up in front of a crowd of people and I am so intent on making them laugh at a certain thing or do a certain thing and give me a response, then it's the ego that's kicked in. And if they don't give me that response, I'm the one who makes it. I'm the one who feels failure. And I can avoid that, because that definitely has kept me from doing certain things. We've all been afraid to do certain things or hesitated to do things because our ego said, if you don't do it right, it's going to hurt. Back to the amygdala there, knowing that the pattern disruption can help us and we can fail forward when we understand that. There's so much. I'm glad you gave it to us. Now, you've got a couple books, and you mentioned a while back your second book, but you didn't even say anything about your first book. So tell us a little bit about your work that you've done with the authoring and some of the other items that you have going on before we close out.
Yeah, so I have the two books are right back here on the wall. The first one, the black one, is Speak for Living, second edition. And then the most recent one is Presentation Essentials. Now, I got lucky. And you know, the definition of luck is being prepared to seize opportunities when they present themselves. So Anne Bruce is a prolific book writer, author, coach. She's a person that works with Hollywood celebrities behind the scenes in TV shows to help them, you know, write the scripts for their shows. She does ghostwriting. She's phenomenal in the Hollywood space, but you wouldn't know her. She's behind the scenes. So she came to me. She had written the Speak for Living back in 2009. And I saw her when she was releasing it through ATD, the Association for Talent Development. And I was the first person in line to get a copy of that book. And I told her I'm going to take that book and be a speaker just like her. At that time, I was not a speaker. And she signed a book, and I'm sure there was like 100 people behind me. And she's like, yeah, okay, great. See you. She didn't know that began the obsession, the stalking. So I read the book and I realized I need this woman in my corner. So I stalked her. She didn't know it. She knows it now. We laugh about it. But I eventually got her and convinced her through some networking and some other things to allow me to hire her for a conference that I was head of the conference committee for, that gave me FaceTime with her. And I asked her to be my mentor. So when ATD, because that first book, first edition of Speak for Living, was a bestseller, they came to her and said they want a second edition. And she said, well, I've got the perfect person who has taken that first edition and actually used it and made himself an international speaker. And believe it or not, ATD said no to her. They knew of me in the ATD conferences, but they didn't know of me on the publishing side. And I was never a publisher. So they told her no. She pushed back and said, if I don't get Sardique to write this book with me, you don't get that book. And they were like, okay. So wrote the book. And then McGraw-Hill came during the pandemic and they said, we recognize that. And by the way, let me go back. That first book, Speak for a Living, is how to launch a speaking, training, coaching, or consulting business and do it in a profitable way. So how to earn $10,000 or more for an hour keynote. That's what that book is all about. So the business of speaking, if you want to do that. This most recent book came out in 22 from McGraw-Hill. And they found some research and said, you know, managers in particular are struggling with presentations. We want a new book on presentation skills, but something different because there's lots of books on the market. So they asked her, because she's worked with them a lot, they asked her to convince me to work with her to write the book and be the technical writer. So that book is all about the you know, partially of some of this neurosciences in there on how to build presentations that are persuasion presentations. And so it's written for that very purpose, how to get people to buy into you and your ideas through presentation skills. So that's the book. And then the third one that I'm now doing research on is going to be around my Leading with Impact program. I've been doing this program for years where I've uncovered, again, the habits of high-performing leaders. What do they do differently? And so in the 32 countries I've worked in the thousands of leaders I've worked with over these last 18 and a half years, I've kind of figured out five key habits that high-performing leaders demonstrate, all of them. So that's the next book. And so I'm in the research phase for that. And I anticipate it'll be something that'll come out in 27 or 28.
Now, say the name of the second book again.
Presentation Essentials is the second book.
I like how you obviously have practiced enough to where you know where to put your fingers for each of the...
Yeah.
Carefully curated.
It's called selling.
Very good. Now, how else can we get your content? Where can we find you?
And I appreciate that. So as you mentioned, LinkedIn, because I'm active of all the social media platforms, that is when I'm most active on. And even then, I post every now and then. Because for me, it's not about quantity, it's about quality. And so LinkedIn is a great place. I've got 10,000 some followers. So if you want to follow me and get in contact with other people in my network, my tribe, as I call them, which you're a great member of, LinkedIn. Now, if you want more frequent content, then subscribe. Go to my website at sardiqlove.com and subscribe to my weekly video blog series, which is on my website, but it's also known as Ask a Master Facilitator. And that's where I take questions from training professionals and answer them on a weekly basis every Monday. So I don't spam. I just send out one email to my subscriber list and say, here's the most recent video. And that's it. So I don't do any other emails to folks other than that. So that's one way to, or two ways to get in touch and stay in touch on a regular basis. And by the way, on my, for those who subscribe to my video blog series, they have direct access to me. So if there's a follow-on question, I actually encourage people to do that and I respond. Feel free. Oh, and lastly, I'll say this, Artrell, because some people may not know, I'm on Facebook and I'm actually pretty active on Facebook with quotes. That's where I test out some of my content on Mondays with, I call it the quote of the week. So I test out contents that I'm going to, quotes that I'm going to use either in my speaking or my book writing. And I get feedback there. And then on Fridays, I have Friday Funny where I post some funny video. These are all clean videos, nothing crazy. So your kids can watch it too. So Facebook, LinkedIn, and then of course my website.
All of the different titles, labels, whatever you want to call them. It just makes me think that you are the facilitation gumbo. You got a little bit of everything there. You put it all together and it just comes out delicious, right? But I appreciate the conversation you had. As I mentioned, I look forward to the posts that you make and the content that you drop. I appreciate, once again, you sitting down and having this conversation with me, and I look forward to more interactions in the future.
Indeed, man. And it's a pleasure and an honor to be a part of this. So I'm looking forward to seeing what you do with this and all the great guests that I already know that you've got planned for this. So I encourage people to subscribe or however they're going to get this content, because this is just the beginning and I'm sure it's going to be just something that's equally delicious. So I'm looking forward to watching what you do here.
I appreciate it. So that's it for this week's episode. We've had Sardiq Love, the international speaker, speak to us today about Taekwondo, leadership through the lens of Taekwondo. We look forward to our next conversation. We'll see you next time.